when I began talking in the United States, I was disinvited from campuses, barred from campuses. There was a lot of hostility, and I compare it now to the fact that it's far easier to speak on behalf of Palestine than on behalf of Israel in American campuses. That's an amazing development. I still find it very difficult to get to official policymakers, to mainstream media. Hopefully this will change. But in terms of major elements in the civil society, I think the pendulum has shifted.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on Palestine, The Pendulum is Shifting. For decades, Palestine and Palestinians were associated with terror and terrorism. In political discourse and popular culture, Palestinians were often typecast as bloodthirsty killers. As the great Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said once ruefully observed, Palestine is a thankless cause, one in which if you truly serve, you get nothing back but opprobrium, abuse, and ostracism. How many friends avoid the subject? How many colleagues want none of Palestine's controversy? How many bien passant liberals have time for Bosnia and Somalia, Rwanda and South Africa, and Nicaragua, and human rights and civil rights everywhere on earth, but not for Palestine and Palestinians? There are signs that that may be changing. A new generation of activists has breathed fresh energy into the question of Palestine. The BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, has attracted more and more adherents. The pendulum is shifting. Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including The Modern Middle East, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and The Biggest Prison on Earth. I talked with him in the studios of KFSR in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome to the program, Ilan Pape.
It's a pleasure to be on your program.
You were born in Haifa in 1954. You taught at the university there from 1984 to 2006. I want to learn a little bit about your background, where your parents came from.
Yes. My parents came from Germany in the early 1930s, and they met in Palestine. I was born 6 years after the 1948 events, grew up on Mount Carmel in the city of Haifa. Those of you who are familiar with Haifa know that the upper part of the city is Jewish and white, so to speak, and the lower you go in the topography, then you start meeting the Palestinians, citizens of the city. I had a very regular Israeli upbringing, both in elementary and high school. I went to the army without any questions. And only after my military service, that included participating in the 1973 war, I began a different path. But until that moment, it was just a normal Israeli-Jewish, I should say Israeli-Jewish Zionist.
So track then for me, if you would, how your politics evolved from someone who served in the Israeli military in 1973.
Yeah. I think, first of all, the war is an experience which changes you in a way. And then I think what also contributed to this was the decision to focus on studying the history of the Middle East and the history of my own country. I mean, I was very keen on history already in high school and definitely as a BA student. And I think this kind of mixture of an academic interest and a certain tendency to be active politically, which not because of any family background, just somewhere it was in me. I don't know why exactly, who's responsible for that. But this kind of fusion of activism and academic interest led me into a very different direction than the one I was sort of going through up to the mid-1970s.
And you joined the University of Haifa in 1984.
Yes. I mean, first of all, I did a BA degree in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And in 1979, 1980, the university suggested that I should complete my PhD students outside of Israel, which I think was the most important formative step that changed my point of view. When you go outside, you see things you cannot see from the inside. And I went to Oxford in England. I did my PhD there with two great supervisors who definitely influenced my position. One was the late Albert Hourani, probably the greatest historian of the modern Middle East ever was. I was his last PhD student. And the late Roger Owen at Harvard, who was at that time quite active on the left in Britain. And the combination of a younger supervisor and kind of a more veteran one, both with a very clear support for the Palestinian people and struggle, was an important influence on my work and on my views. And I went back to Haifa in 1984, believing that what I found in the archives and wrote about in my PhD on 48 would be welcomed by the Israeli academic community, because it was based on pure academic research. But to my surprise, this was not the case, of course. But I succeeded in remaining in Israeli academia until both sides, that is, myself and the academia, found it was too much and we could not coexist.
Well, what were the circumstances that caused you to leave the University of Haifa?
There were several issues, but I think the most important one is that the way I taught and the way I researched was deemed by most Israeli academics as treason. That was the issue. I mean, even before me, there were people who were saying the same thing, but there never were professional historians. There were chemists, there were physicists. I was probably one of the first professional historian paid by the state to teach history who challenged the national narrative. And this was too much for the academia, for the political system, for the Ministry of Education, and so on. So they put strong pressure on me. Eventually, they wanted to bring me for a disciplinary trial. And there was an international outcry because of that. And they made life so miserable that I really couldn't stay. And they started also affecting my students and so on. So I really had to leave.
Well, you had international support, you say, but what about within the country? Did your colleagues go to bat for you, as we say in American English?
No, they didn't. And that was very disappointing. And years later, some of them regretted of not being bold enough to support, but they were really timid and did not have the courage. Although they thought that what was done to me was not right, apart from a few, the vast majority did not dare to voice support in public.
It's 52 years since the 1967 war and the subsequent occupation of the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, 71 years since the establishment of the State of Israel and the Palestinian Nakba. Those events are still vividly active in the psyche and the politics of Israel and of the Palestinian people.
Yes, that is true. I mean, there is a saying by a great scholar of settler colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, who used to say that settler colonialism is not an event, but a structure. And what he meant by this is that these are not discrete points in time, that is, the 67 war or the 48 war. We are still within the historical period that started in 1948. We don't have a closure for that period. And the two events, 48 and 67, are connected. Unfortunately, those who are engaged with the peace process in Israel and Palestine disconnect the two events and don't understand that the failure of the peace process is exactly because these two events are not connected, as if the conflict started in 67. From a Palestinian perspective, this idea that we are still in the same historical process is manifested in what they call the in Arabic, al-Nakba al-Mustamirra, the ongoing Nakba, the ongoing catastrophe. And the catastrophe is the fact that, like all settler colonial movements, Zionism wanted a space without the native population, almost succeeded in doing it in 1948, became greedy for more territory in 1967, and therefore still left with the demographic conundrum that there is a large number, a sizable number, of the native indigenous people of Palestine that, from a Zionist perspective, are aliens and potentially can be hostile aliens that disrupt and obstruct the way for a successful completion of the project of building a Jewish national homeland in the ancient, as the Israelis would call it, the ancient land of Israel. And I think this is where 48 and 67 are so much connected and should be treated as the real issue at hand.
Give us a working definition of Zionism.
Well, Zionism's definition changed over time. It emerged as a response to two impulses. The first impulse was of Jews to find security and survival with the rise of anti-Semitism, especially in Eastern Europe. Zionism was one of the many, not the only, response of Jews to the sense that their life in Europe is not secure. Some people went to international communism, others went to liberalism. One of the response was, well, if life is not secure here, we have to find a safe place outside of Europe. So that was one response of Zionism. The second one was, which is typical to many other cultural and ethnic groups at the time in the big empires, whether it was the Ottoman Empire or within the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a lot of religious groups began to define themselves in national terms. And Judaism was not different in that response. So it was an impulse for
Judaism is a religion.
Yes, but so is so are Maronites and Armenians. There is a confusion between ethnicity and religion in that part of the world. Zionism was, like many other movements, an attempt to take a religious identity and adapt it to the new language of nationalism. And by itself, this was the kind of the definition of Zionism to begin with, a search for a safe haven and reinventing Judaism as nationalism. Zionism became something different the moment it honed upon one territory, which is Palestine. The Zionist movement was looking for all kinds of locations around the world in which to express their right to self-determination and safety, including in the United States, in upstate New York. But eventually they focused on Palestine. And at that moment, they became a settler colonial project and not just a national revival project. And from that moment onward, which is, one can say, the beginning of the 20th century onwards, Zionism is a settler colonialist ideology. It believes in redeeming the ancient homeland of Israel and sees the native indigenous population as aliens who usurped the homeland. And if you are a leftist within the Zionist perspective, you tolerate to a certain extent the presence of others under certain restrictions. And if you are sort of mainstream or right-wing, you even see the options of getting rid of them as a legitimate way of securing the redemption of the ancient homeland. So it's an ideology that defines who you are by saying who you are not, which is typical both to colonialism and nationalism.
But was Zionism predicated on the famous slogan of a land without people for a people without a land?
Yes, in many ways, because of the terra nulla idea, that it's both in a way. On the one hand, you needed to have a romantic nationalist view of a country of origin. So they found it through the Old Testament, the Bible, although most of the Zionists were secular. I always say the Zionists are people who did not believe in God, but they believed that God promised them Palestine. And so the one thing was an ancient homeland. You needed that in order to solidify a new national identity. And secondly, you had to look at the land and say, it's possible to build myself in it as a new nation because it's empty. Now, it's not empty. So the people who are there do not belong to the place. That's why it's empty. And if it's not empty now, it will be empty later, because that's the historical justice of it. So Zionism was this whole idea that, first of all, Judaism is far more a national identity than a religious one. Secondly, that it can only survive, Judaism can only survive in the ancient homeland, which is typical romantic nationalist view of nationalism, and that the main obstacle are the people who live there and do not belong to the tribe, do not belong to the ethnicity, and they have to be removed in one way or another. And the fact that you cannot remove them because they resist is part of your way of life. You either continue until you become a triumphant settler colonialist project by destroying the indigenous people, or you change your dogma. You know, there's a cognitive dissonance there between what you believe and want and the reality. And as we know, people solve cognitive dissonances either by changing the reality or changing the cognition. We'll see what will happen in the future.
Why does the Israeli-Palestinian conflict command so much attention? In terms of atrocities and massacres and killings, it pales in comparison, let's say, to what's been happening in the Eastern Congo or Myanmar and other parts of the
Absolutely.
World. Why is this issue so central? I mean, there's library shelves of books and articles, endless amount of research being produced on Israel-Palestine. Why?
Yeah. Well, there are several reasons for that. One, it's the duration of the oppression and the colonialism, which goes on and on. It's the only part of the colonialist reality in the Middle East that has no closure. Even Algeria was liberated in 1962. So Palestine remains as an open colonialist wound compared to any other parts of the world where at least decolonization effectively happened. The second reason, I think, which is very important, is the double talk about Palestine. The other places you mentioned, nobody questions the atrocities. Nobody questions the existence of violations of human rights and civil rights. It's the only place in the world where what you see is not what you get. In other words, that people deny that there are violations of human rights, that there are violations of civil rights. Palestinians' point of view only recently began to be heard, but until recently, they were like victims of crimes, and they relived the crime twice, once when it occurred, and secondly when it was denied. And I think the denial of the crime is sometimes more important than the magnitude of the crime. And you're absolutely right, there are worst cases around the world today and in history, but very few of them were at that level of constant denial. The third reason has a lot to do with the fact that the Western world is still dominating what is important and not important, or newsworthy or not newsworthy, or research-worthy or not. And the Western world has a problem with the Jewish question. And it was hoped, I think, by many people that the creation of the State of Israel would bring a closure on that ugly chapter in modern Western history. But it didn't, as we know. It's just created another problem and did not allow Europe really to have a closure with what it had done to the Jews, not only during the Second World War, but over centuries, if not.
You write about Israeli state policy seeking, the word you use is fragment the Palestinians, to render whatever opposition or resistance there is to be ineffective. How is that implemented?
From the very beginning, even before the creation of the State of Israel, the Zionist movement tried, and unsuccessfully, to drive wedges within the Palestinian politics and community, first trying to exploit clashes between leading clans like the Nashashibis and the Husseinis, then between Christians and Muslims, and it didn't work. Then, after the creation of the State of Israel, they created a kind of hierarchy of good Arabs and bad Arabs. The Druze are the best Arabs. The Muslims are the worst Arabs. But again, this didn't work. Palestinian nationalism is based on the secular idea that your religion does not matter. What matters is whether you are part of the national movement or not. And a similar kind of division was done physically in 48. I mean, the very fragmentation of Palestine into the West Bank, Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the refugee communities is a huge fragmentation that made it very difficult for the Palestinians to reignite the national liberation struggle. I mean, the biggest achievement of Arafat, people forget about it, was to keep a united Palestinian front despite of the physical fragmentation that Israel imposed on the Palestinians in 1948. After the 67 war, Israel continued to create this kind of apartheid hierarchy. If you were a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you were better off than a Palestinian in the West Bank. And if you were a Palestinian in the West Bank, you were better off than the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And if you were a refugee, you were in the worst kind of situation. And this is not incidental. It's part of an intentional policy of fragmentation that meant to disempower the Palestinians to the point of submission to accept the Israeli interpretation of reality. And part of the biggest Palestinian challenge is how to unite a fragmented people. And without this unity, as we know from the reality, it will be very difficult to succeed in the liberation struggle against Zionism in Israel.
Talk about what occupation does to the occupier.
Yeah. Well, I think what we know now is that the way of life as a jailer, as an occupier, as a colonizer, does not allow you to distinguish between the reality in the world of occupation and in your own household, if you want. So if the major way of life, the main way of life as an occupier, as a jailer, as a colonizer, is violence, dehumanization of the other, total oblivion to human rights and civil rights, not surprisingly, you continue to have these same kinds of attitudes also in your own home, if you want, household, or in your own space. So there is an increase in violence, in domestic violence, there's an increase in the violence in the public sphere, and there is a corruption of the morality of the next generation that would be very difficult to repair in the future.
Now, you write in your book with Noam Chomsky called On Palestine, the Zionist left has disappeared from the political scene in Israel for all intents and purposes. How and why did that happen? And how left was the left, really?
Yeah, right. Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand that if we accept the definition of Zionism as settler colonialism, and Israel is a settler colonial state, then we understand that if you are working as a leftist within the boundaries of the Zionist ideology, there is a problem. Being a liberal colonialist is an oxymoron, and being a liberal Zionist is an oxymoron, therefore. You cannot be a leftist Zionist. History showed that it was impossible. You could not adhere to universal values if you could not adhere to them vis-a-vis the indigenous native population of Palestine. So you create a kibbutz which is very egalitarian and socialist, but you don't admit Palestinian citizens to the kibbutz. Actually, you don't even admit Jews who came from the Arab world, but that's another story, to the kibbutz. So you immediately, the way you implement universal values, which is at the heart of what the left is all about, the moment you implement universal values and you give precedence to the ethnic and national values over these universal values, you have no chance of either becoming effective politically or of surviving politically. And that's what happened to the Israeli left, the Zionist left. The Israeli Zionist left had nothing to sell to the electorate of the Israelis because they sold an impossible idea. We are both Jewish and democratic state. And Israelis live through that reality and know that it doesn't work. So most Israelis would say, if I have to choose between a democratic state and an ethnic state, I would rather have the ethnic state, even if it's a racist state. I don't want a democracy, if this is what I have to choose. The left deceived us, they would say. They told us we don't have to make this choice. But you do have to make this choice. You can't have both. You can have one or the other. And I think that's the failure. The failure was to mislead the Israeli electorate, and in many ways the world, that this is a possible way of squaring the circle. And once the Israeli electorate discovered that this is not working, they chose the ethnic road or the apartheid road or whatever you want to call it over the universal values that supposedly the left believed in them.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, in 2018 passed a law about the nature of Israel, and it also had something to say about relegating Arabic to a secondary status as a language. Yeah. Could you talk about that?
The Israeli nationality law is very important. First of all, one should say it's what we call in Israel a foundational law or constitutional law. We don't have a constitution, but we have constitutional laws, which means it's very difficult to change them. They have the status of a constitution. Secondly, it's the first time that an Israeli government, and a parliament, rather, stated clearly the position towards the land of Palestine and the people of Palestine. The law makes a distinction between two concepts. One is the land of Israel and one is the state of Israel. And the law says clearly that in what is today the state in Israel and what would be the future state of Israel, there will be only one national group, the Jewish people. And the other people would be the people who speak Arabic. So they degraded even the Palestinians who used to be Arab citizens of Israel are now citizens who speak Arabic, which is kind of degrading them even more in terms of not being part of the common good, the common republic, if you want. The state, the land of Israel, this is the state of Israel. But the law says clearly that the state of Israel would expand into the rest of the land of Israel. What they mean is the West Bank. And the law says clearly that the principal means of extending the state of Israel over the rest of the land of Israel is settlement. So what the law says is that, let's say, Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, would be annexed to Israel, and then the Palestinians who live there would become Israeli citizens with the special status that the other Israeli Palestinian citizens in Israel have, that is, without any rights for national identity, collective identity, and without privileges such as access to the land, to subsidies, budgets, and without, of course, changing anything in the environment of racism and intimidation under which they have been living.
You're listening to Ilan Pape on Palestine. The pendulum is shifting. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Now, crucially, you've mentioned Area C, and for people who are not familiar with the Oslo Accords, mm-hmm. it divided the West Bank, occupied West Bank, into three areas, Area A, B, and C. C, you say, is 60% of the entire West Bank area. You write that the Palestinians in Areas A and B are incarcerated in cages. What do you mean by that?
I mean that and anyone who visited Areas A and B would know exactly what I'm talking about. They are enclaved with a belt of Jewish settlements and military bases and checkpoints that do not allow them to move sometimes from a village to another village, sometimes from a village to a town. And anyway, any movement outside of a village or a town depends on the goodwill of the Israeli army. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. The city of Bethlehem is about 25 minutes drive from Ramallah, 25 minutes. Because Israel doesn't want Palestinians from Bethlehem to go through Jerusalem to Ramallah, they have to drive for about 2 hours to get to Ramallah. And of course, if the Israeli army wants, it closes the road. Another example for that kind of caging that I'm talking about, you have whole cities or towns such as Tulkarem, Jenin, Qalqilya that are surrounded by a fence, high fence, that the Israelis control, and there's only one exit out of the town. And the exit is controlled by the Israeli army, recently by private companies. And they decide whether you can go out of the city or come back into the city. I don't think there's any phenomenon like this in the world. Therefore, I was using the metaphor of prison because I haven't seen it anywhere else in the world. I don't know whether it exists anywhere else. The idea that Santa Fe would be encircled by fence, barbed wire. There will be only one entrance to Santa Fe. An American soldier would sit there and decide whether you can go back or go out of your city. There are certain no-go areas for Palestinians. The most important ones are the roads. There are roads which are exclusively for the Jewish settlers, and Palestinians are not allowed to drive on them. And then there are green areas, like where you have, you know, some recreational parks, where Palestinians are not allowed to go in the West Bank. I'm talking in the West Bank. And there are, more importantly than anything else, there are water resources which are Palestinians are not allowed to use. Israel controls the water and the air as well as the space. This is how tight the control of the West Bank is.
Now, you've called the figure of 600,000 settlers on the West Bank a conservative one. It may be actually higher. This is fulfilling a kind of Israeli state policy of creating facts on the ground. There's a fait accompli. There's no way that those settlers are going to be moved out. So wither the possibility of a viable Palestinian state?
No, I don't think it's a viable option anymore. I doubt whether it ever was, but definitely giving the facts on the ground, the way that the Jewish settlement bisects the West Bank, and the way that these settlements are located and the way they are spread means that there will not be a territorial integrity for a future Palestinian state. That's one issue. The second issue is not just the presence of the Jewish settlers, but their kind of legal status. They are not subject to the same legal system as the Palestinians are. And therefore, they are already a privileged community within the West Bank. And you cannot have a state, an independent Palestinian state, with such a presence of another group of people who have privileges. Not to mention the fact that there is a consensus in Israel that the Israeli army would always have a free hand when it comes to a Palestinian state, that they could go in and out whenever they want, arrest people, usually without trial, demolish houses, and so on. So the reality in which, let's say, a Palestinian state would have to operate does not resemble anything we know about statehood. It would be, at best, a Bantustan in the days of apartheid South Africa, and at worst, it would be something like a ghetto during the medieval times.
Talk about Gaza, this strip along the Mediterranean coast. It's about 40 miles long, 10 miles wide. Your book is called The Biggest Prison on Earth.
Right. Yes, Gaza is a particular model of the Israeli prison, if you want. I think also areas A and B are sort of mega prison in the sense that the mentality of the prison is used there, or the concept of the prison is used for areas A and B. But of course, as I say in my new book, The Biggest Prison on Earth, areas A and B are ruled like an open mega prison. It's a mega open prison, a much more relaxed prison in the sense of what the inmates are allowed to do in the prison, and even at times are allowed to work outside of the prison. That's really the same model. The Gaza Strip is a maximum security prison, a mega maximum security prison, which is punitive. It's a punitive incarceration. It's not just preventing people the freedom of movement, which is what the jail does to an individual, which is happening in areas A and B, but people are incarcerated in a punitive measure, namely, because they resist the prison, they are occasionally punished collectively for that. And Israel is using its military might to punish the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip for not obeying the Israeli idea of how the whole of historical Palestine should be managed. And the punitive actions include sometimes military operations, as we know, using the Israeli might to devastate the Gaza Strip. And On a daily basis, they use the siege of the Gaza Strip, the blockade, because Gaza has a coast. So the combination of a land siege and a naval blockade to punish the people there by controlling the food that they get, the health aid, the basic infrastructure for life, which led the United Nations to predict that next year, 2020, the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip would not be able to be sustained economically, and they predict a huge human catastrophe next year because of the ongoing siege and blockade of the Strip.
Now, the almost liturgical Israeli state response to the situation in Gaza, which causes it to bomb and invade it from time to time, is that it's self-defense. We're being attacked through tunnels. Rockets are being launched on our cities. Any civilized country would defend its population against these kinds of attacks. How do you respond to that?
Yes, the Israelis are very good at choosing a departure point in history which is convenient for them. So they start the story with the Hamas launching rockets into Israel and say that's when it started. But this is not when it started. What happened in 2005 and 2006, that unlike some other areas in the occupied territories, the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip chose to allow the Hamas to try its own way of bringing an end to the brutal and inhuman occupation. So they elected the Hamas government. The reaction of Israel was to take out the settlers and to encircle Gaza and turn it into a ghetto. So the violent Israel imposed on the people of Gaza, because they chose a more national liberation movement, if you want, than the previous ones, that is what started the violence. Now, as a reaction to the siege, the Hamas is using a primitive system of warfare that so far did not cost many Israeli life at all. And the Israelis are using this as a pretext, of course, to punish the Palestinians even further. So this whole idea that Israel is doing in the Gaza Strip what he's doing as self-defense is not true. You know, in 2005, I and some colleagues warned the world that the reason the Israelis are taking out the settlers from the Gaza Strip is not because they want to concede area territory to the Palestinians, because they want a free hand to bomb Gaza without fearing that they will hurt Jewish settlers who live there. And lo and behold, a year afterwards, that's the first time that Israel used devastating military power to punish the Palestinians. They didn't need to be more, how should I say, pharmaceutical in their or clinical in their attacks anymore on Gaza, because there were no Jewish settlers there.
How do you view the Israeli media? Journalism, it was once highly regarded as being cutting edge and very critical. Does that obtain today?
I don't think it was ever very critical. The two watchdogs of society, like academia and media in Israel, are totally recruited to the ideology of the state. They would criticize a policy here and there, but they would never dare to criticize the very ideological core of the state. And as long as they don't do that, their criticism is in many ways welcomed by most Israelis, because it broadcasts the idea that Israel is a democracy. It's almost like media during the heyday of apartheid, they would criticize certain actions that the apartheid government would take, but would not dare to criticize apartheid itself. This has always been the way Israeli media reacted.
Well, some Israelis might say, well, you know, democracy has its flaws, but Israel is the only functioning democracy in a region full of autocrats and monarchs.
Yeah, I don't think any textbook on democracy would be able to be used in order to justify this definition of Israel. You have 12 million people living between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. Millions of them are citizenless citizens in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Those who are inside Israel are discriminated against in every walk of life. when more than 50% of the people who are under your control do not enjoy basic human and civil rights, you are not a democracy.
How has the Trump presidency affected the politics of Israel-Palestine?
Not much, one should say. Actually.
Really? Even with the embassy and all of that?
I don't think so. I think that I don't buy into the Trump effect, I must say. I think Obama did not do anything positive either, and he was the big hope for us. And we always remember that the first speech he gave after he was elected was to AIPAC. And he gave military aid to Israel on a level that no president before him gave. The only difference between Trump and the previous administration is that he's much more honest about the American position. It's a welcome, for me, it's a welcome development. I mean, I'd rather have the true face of American support for Israel exposed than the wishy-washy way of putting it by condemning the settlements but allowing them. The movement of the capital to Jerusalem was just a symbolic act which was not as important as the fact that Trump said openly what the previous administration said secretly. We will always support the Israeli point of view, and therefore we cannot be honest brokers. And they were never, America was never an honest broker. And if Trump would take the United States out of the Israel-Palestine peace process, this would be a blissful moment in the history of that country. Taking America out of the Middle East as a whole would be a blissful moment for the region as a whole. American legacy in the Middle East and in Palestine is a negative legacy of destruction, of allowing fanaticism to emerge at the price of more universalist movements. I cannot wait for the moment that the United States would say that it's not interested in the Middle East and in Palestine anymore.
But you've said that changing American public opinion is a crucial element in changing the reality on the ground in Israel and Palestine.
Absolutely.
So how do you reach American public opinion? You're at a university in the southwest of England.
First of all, you think about societies as also having a younger generation. And you have to understand what ticks a younger generation. And, of course, the Internet is so important for shaping people's positions. But also for providing information that the mainstream media refuses to provide. What we would like from the American public opinion is two things. One is to use a universal value system, if you want, of human rights and civil rights and apply it to Israel. And secondly, understand that unless America would champion human rights and civil rights in Palestine, it's much better not to have it involved. Because when it is involved without that kind of a value system, it supports colonization, occupation, and destruction. And I think this is very important for educating the American taxpayer for what the money is used for and what kind of damage it does to American national interest in the long run.
There's a full-page ad in the New York Times from the World Jewish Congress, and it says in part, "The age-old hatred of Jews now disguises itself as anti-Zionism, an irrational hatred of Israel we have seen in the halls of the UN and on college campuses under the guise of the BDS movement." BDS is Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It started in 2005, and it has gained some traction here and in Europe and elsewhere. What do you think of the BDS movement?
Well, I think, first of all, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement, so this whole page is a fabrication, is a lie. So unless self-hating Judaism is anti-Semitism as well, I suppose. Secondly, the BDS movement is a response of the civil society in the West to a call by the civil society of the Palestinians to do something to stop the kind of reality we were talking about in the last hour. Because the political elites do not stop it. Israel has immunity for its impunity. And as in the case of apartheid South Africa, the case of Pinochet in Chile, of the general's regime in Argentina, civil society feels it has the tools to say to the governments, you have the power, You can do two things. One is stop supporting oppression, and secondly, take a proactive role against them. That's what the BDS is all about. This has nothing to do with Judaism. This has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. The main veteran activists of the BDS were the ones who fought for civil rights in the United States, who fought against apartheid in South Africa, who fight against injustice all over the world. And therefore, you could not say that if you supported the fall of the apartheid regime in South Africa, you were anti-Christian. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's a pathetic and unfortunately effective for the time being Israeli Zionist response for moral stance that anyone in the world with a modicum of decency in them take against the atrocities that occur on the ground.
There was an op-ed in the New York Times entitled "Time to Break the Silence on Palestine." This was written by Michelle Alexander, yes, who is an opinion columnist for the New York Times, talking about King's courage to speak out against the silence around Vietnam and the current silence, particularly in the United States, around Israel-Palestine.
Yes, I think it's a very important landmark, this article, because the New York Times was very careful in not allowing straightforward criticism of Israel as a state, but rather just on policies. And I think it's one of the first articles that goes to the core of the problem. And it's an indication that in this age of knowledge and transparency, it's very difficult to hide what Israel is doing and why Israel is doing what it does. And I think that in many ways, activists who worked in the United States in the last 20, 30 years should be commended for the work they have done. I think that's the product of a work of a solidarity movement in this country that worked day and night to re-educate people about Palestine and show them that from a moral point of view, as Americans, there is only one position to be taken, and that's the position that Michelle Alexander expresses in this article.
Mehmoud Darwish, often described as the national poet of Palestine, you actually met him.
Yes, I did.
Tell me about him.
Well, he's an amazing personality, very much aware of also the Jewish life in Israel. As you know, he had a Jewish girlfriend, and he wrote her some beautiful poems.
And he spoke perfect Hebrew.
Perfect Hebrew. Mm. And I think he understood well both the Palestinian destiny and exactly the essence of the Palestinian tragedy in Palestine. But this was done without hatred and without a sense of retribution. And I think he really was encompassing this idea that Zionism was a crime against the Palestinian people. But three generations later, we need to find a restitutive justice that would allow, if you want, the criminals and the victims to share the land without creating more catastrophes and inhumanity. In many ways, I think that's why the Israelis feared him so much, because he was on the one hand a national poet, but he was also a very humane poet. And this did not work well for Israel, the fact that you can be pro-Palestinian from a national point of view, but also from a universalist humanist point of view.
In his poem, "The Earth is Closing on Us," he asks, "Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Where should the Palestinians go?"
Well, they're not going anywhere. I think that's what the Israelis are learning. They're not going anywhere. They will stay in Palestine, and they will continue to struggle for Palestine. And Israelis should learn history. That you look at any other systems that were using injustice and ask themselves whether this could be sustained in the long run. And I'm afraid it cannot be sustained in the long run. And we should be thankful that after 100 years of colonization, the basic impulse of Palestinians is still to have normal life and shared life with Israelis. And as long as this is there, there's a chance for reconciliation and peace.
Edward Said embraced the one-state solution. Mm-hmm. Talk about two-state versus one-state, and yeah, what is your position?
I'm totally in. I'm part of a new campaign which is called the One Democratic State Campaign in Palestine, which encompasses Jews and Palestinians on the ground and in the refugee communities. I think the two-state solution was an Israeli idea, allowing the fragmentation of the Palestinian people as a divide-and-rule method. I think Palestinians, understandably, especially those who lived in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, hoped, and I can understand it, that the two-state solution would bring an end to the military occupation. But the facts on the ground and the real intentions of the Israelis, including the Israeli left, was never to allow an independent sovereign state, even in that part of Palestine, which is 22% of the Palestinian homeland. So I think ideologically, morally, and practically, this is not any more a feasible solution. And the only way forward is to try and see how you can build from below and from above a political regime that would respect the collective rights of both communities, the right of the Palestinian refugees to return, and basically would end the regime of privileges that the Israeli Jews have over the indigenous native population of Palestine. It won't be easy, but we wasted 50 years of not doing that. Hopefully we will start doing it in the next 50 years and look for the problem where it really exists and not where it did not exist.
How would you respond to Israeli nationalists who say there is only one Jewish state and a one-state solution, it would lose its identity?
Well, both Palestinians and Israelis would have to give up a little bit about the idea of a nation state. I'm not a great supporter of nationalism anyway, but they would have to give up the idea of a nation state if they want to share the land together. And I think that if the only way of having a Jewish state is through the means of upholding an apartheid racist state, it's better not to have such a state. And I think Jews would be far more secure and far more kind of peace with themselves in a state or in a country that accepts them and in a region that host them, rather than being an alien and an alienated factor, as they are, in a region which eventually might have the upper hand over them. So I think it's a vision that they should really cherish and accept, given the historical circumstances that brought them over to that country.
You visit and travel in the United States. In general, what kind of receptivity do you find here? And have you seen a change?
Oh yes, I've seen when I began talking in the United States, I could hardly enter a campus. I was disinvited from campuses, barred from campuses. There was a lot of hostility towards the ideas that I broadcast. I think the word Palestine was synonymous with terrorism in those days, and I compare it now to the fact that it's far easier to speak on behalf of Palestine than on behalf of Israel in American campuses. That's an amazing development. I think the alternative media has contributed to that as well. I still find it very difficult to get to official policymakers, to mainstream media. It's still very difficult to have a dialogue with them. Hopefully this will change. But in terms of major elements in the civil society, I think the pendulum has shifted, and there's far more support for the Palestinian rights than there was ever before in this country.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Ilan Pape on Palestine, The Pendulum is Shifting. I talked with him in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Ilan Pape is professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. For many years, he taught at the University of Haifa in Israel. He's the author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and The Biggest Prison on Earth. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Ralph Nader, Miko Peled, Arjun Singh Sethi, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. And we have a series of programs on the Middle East. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Sean Conlon of KSFR recorded the program. Special thanks to Mary Charlotte Domani and the Lannan Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.